everyone, it's Maria.
And this is Jordan. Welcome back to Major Musings.
Welcome back. How you doing, Jordan?
I'm doing decently. You know, we're we're in the period of time where we're finding out about grad school, so we're just a little, both of us are just a little stressed, but, you know.
It's fine. For those who would like to know or are curious about keeping up with our journeys, as of right now, out of the 11 that I've applied to, I have one acceptance and 5 rejections.
And I've been rejected by 4 and I'm waiting on 5 still. So, you know, I feel like it's important for us to talk about it so that people know like what it is really like, and that you're not going to get into a lot of places, and that's just how it goes sometimes.
Honestly, and I mean, I'm curious about anyone who's listening who maybe has also applied to PhDs. All the rejections that Jordan and I have received are the PhD programs. My single acceptance is a master's. So I think for anyone out there who's going through the same thing, just know that it's just a million times more competitive now with COVID. So
exactly.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. How are you, though, otherwise?
Otherwise, I'm doing good. I'm excited to be talking about the artist this week on our podcast.
Yeah, so. Me too. I'm ready for you to go. I'm ready to not think about grad school and learn about a new artist.
Perfect. So we'll jump right in. So today, I'll be talking about Bahia Shib. She has a lot of titles. She's Egyptian-based. She's an artist, activist, designer, creative director, historian, and educator.
Wow.
And I actually do not explicitly remember where this happened, but I came across a TED Talk of hers several years ago. It's actually a very popular video of hers. You can find it in our link tree of sources. It'll be up with everything else that I'll be including in this episode. And in this video, Shib talks about how her series, 1,000 Times No, came to life. And this series will actually be the main topic of conversation for the episode. So it all started many years ago, actually back in 2010. So Shib was invited to be featured in an exhibition at the Chat Foundation in Germany. Mm-hmm. And actually, for those who don't know, Chat translates to writing, or like handwriting / calligraphy in Arabic.
It's
translation. Yeah, so this exhibition was celebrating 100 years of Islamic art in Europe, and the curator of the show only had one condition, which makes sense given the namesake of the foundation, that Shib include Arabic calligraphy in her piece. So in her TED Talk, Shib says that the first thing that she wanted to say was no. And ironically, that's what gave her the idea. So in Arabic, there is this phrase that we tend to say if we're really trying to emphasize or no, basically we say no 1,000 times no.
Oh, okay.
So she chose to take that phrase and approach it literally. She did an extensive amount of research looking for the word no written 1,000 different ways in anything produced that under Arabic or Islamic patronage globally, from Spain to China. I mean, our culture extends across like 1400 years. At least that's the time period that she worked in and researched.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Arab influence and Islamic influence extends globally as well. So she definitely went all in on this one and found literally 1,000 different iterations of no.
So what do you mean exactly by iteration? Was it like she saw like no written in a newspaper from this country or used in a book from another country? Like what exactly do you mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's actually when you look at her installation, that will be posted on our Instagram. When you look at the installation, it's more of what the no looks like aesthetically and how it was written in anything that was produced. So any work of art, any kind of artifact, wherever she found it, she kind of traced that design and put it in there.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Yeah.
After completing her research, she documented all of these no's in a book that was displayed next to her actual piece in the exhibition. And that piece was a massive installation. It was 7 meters tall, 3 meters wide, and it was just rows upon rows of the word no written in different ways.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is wild. That's so cool.
Yeah, so Jordan's currently looking at the images.
Yeah.
Which you will find on our Instagram. But yeah, that was what it was. And this is what she wrote for the exhibition. And you can find this on the foundation's website, which will also be included in our link tree of sources. So she said, "When you want to deny all of the stereotypes that are imposed on you and that try to define your role in the world, when you want to reject almost every aspect of your reality, when you want to decline every political reality you live under, when you want to dismiss all of the options available to you, when you want to negate all the accusations that go hand in hand with your identity, when you want to refuse to be an imitator or follower of the West, yet you also refuse the regressive interpretation of your heritage, 1,000 no's are not enough."
Wow.
Yeah, so I mean, as I was researching for this and I read that, I was kind of speechless for a second, and I just loved it. And I've mentioned this so many times before, but one of the reasons why I love researching art from the Arab region and why I'm choosing to commit to that in my career is because of how it makes me feel. I mean, sure, as a scholar, I do need to be factual and objective at times, but I cannot tell you how refreshing it is to just sit and read an artist statement or look at their work and think, wow, okay, I really felt that. I know exactly what she means. I know exactly how she's feeling, mm-hmm. because that's how I feel on a daily basis.
Yes, it's more powerful for you in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, in that paragraph and in this piece, she challenges the stereotypes. She rejects this idea of conformity in Arab and or Islamic culture. Often the two are also being considered as interchangeable, but her mm-hmm. her work and the way that you see literally a single word could be written 1,000 different ways, it just shows you how diverse the culture is and has been across time and across history.
Yeah, I, you know, upon zooming in to look at the detail of it, I was shocked at how different it all looks. I mean, some of it, it's some of them are so ornate. Some of them are so much more simple where, mm-hmm. I mean, you might, if you are not familiar with Arabic, which I am not very familiar with it, you might not even recognize it at all. Right. Like, it just looks like it could be a decorative feature of something. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and it shows you, I mean, the beauty and the power of Arabic calligraphy has been such a quintessential aspect of the culture, mm-hmm. not only because of what calligraphy represents, but the way that different people from different regions interpret and write in this kind of formal calligraphy. And there are obviously, as you can see from this, so many ways that you can write it.
Yeah, it's so I'm seeing in one of the images mm-hmm. where it looks like it's in a book. There's some text under each of the different words. So does she include like the country or the culture from where she found that one?
Yeah, so basically this book is kind of like her archive of everything she found. And under each of them, she explains to you where she found it, when it's dated to, what country it is from. So it is it's such an incredibly detailed piece of work. Like one of the most detailed I've ever seen.
Yeah. So. Do you know So you said this started in 2010. Do you know how long it took her, though, to compile all of this?
I'm not sure. I don't know when the curator from the foundation reached out to her. I'm assuming at some point in 2010, if not earlier.
Right.
And then the exhibition went up in September of 2010.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm sure she would have had a couple months to do this.
Yeah.
At the very least.
It seems like it would take a long time to find all of this.
It's just so extensive. But that, and that's where her different, you know, the different titles she hold come into play, because she's also a historian and an educator. She's a professor at the University of Cairo in Egypt. So
oh, okay.
She would be able to probably have access to quite a few things and utilize that in her art, which I think is what makes her so interesting as a creative person.
Yeah, definitely, to have that other training, or then just the other resources that someone might not necessarily have if you were just working somewhere else.
Right.
Like not in a university setting, perhaps.
Yeah. She's a multidisciplinary artist, really, is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
So it's actually very interesting because, you know, in a way, with the political circumstances in Egypt around that time, which she wasn't even taking into consideration with this piece, the work shifts in its meaning. So the exhibition went up in September of 2010, like I said, and then on January 25, 2011, the revolution in Egypt began. And it's important to note because it marks that shift from her work that was once a celebration of a diverse culture to something that she then used as a political tool during those protests.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah. So I figured for background, because even I didn't really know extensively all that much about it, the Egyptian Revolution of 2011 was what marked the end of Hosni Mubarak's presidency, which was 3 decades long.
Oh, wow.
So it was basically a dictatorship. Yeah. Right? So activists in Egypt flooded the streets. They protested against poverty, unemployment, government corruption, and Mubarak himself. And they called for an uprising in the country.
Okay.
And it lasted 18 days. So it was from January 25th to February 11th, I believe. And in her TED talk, you know, Shihab said that life stopped for 18 days, basically. Which was inevitable because there were violent and brutal clashes between protesters and police. And, you know, with life stopping, the government tried to silence the people. They disabled Facebook services, Twitter services, BlackBerry Messenger services. Many people reported that there was major disruption in their internet and their text messages as well.
Wow.
Yeah, so eventually, on February 11th, after weeks of protests, after hundreds of deaths, thousands of injuries, Mubarak finally resigned and handed over power to the army, right? So Shihab says that at that moment, people went out and celebrated, but she says that that was very naive, believing that the corruption was over and that change would occur. And one of the reasons why she came to that realization was because of the images she kept seeing on social media proving otherwise. You know, there were just images being posted everywhere of people being violated, people being killed and thrown on the streets by the army. Oh. So to quote her, she said, "I did not feel that I could live in a city where people were being killed and thrown like garbage on the street." So she found herself on those same streets several months later in November, graffitiing the word no wherever she could with an added message. So she started by tracing the calligraphy of the word no off of a tombstone from the Islamic Museum in Cairo, and then she added a message underneath it. So it was no to military rule. And eventually, she started taking all the no's that she had included in her book from the exhibition, and she started graffitiing those as well with many other messages. And she described it as kind of like ammunition, just taking all of these no's and putting them everywhere, you know, and each of them, I won't go into the details too much here, but if people want to know, she would take certain stories that were happening to individual people and she would create messages from those, you know, stories. So No to a New Pharaoh hints at, you know, it was a 3-decade long dictatorship practically. We don't want that. We want a presidency. Mm-hmm. No to Violence. No to Blinding Heroes. So that referred to a protester who lost one eye in January and then lost his other eye in protests in November.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so, and then No to Killing and No to Killing Men of Religion, because I believe one religious man was killed as well. No to burning books, which the army did. No to stripping the people. No to barrier walls. So basically, she took all of these, she graffitied them everywhere. And the one about stripping the people is especially important. And if you look at some of the images of the graffitied art on the wall, you might see that there's a blue bra.
Oh, yeah.
Along with some of her no labels. So this is pointed at a very specific image that went around on social media. We will obviously not be sharing this, but, you know, a warning to anyone who might go and watch Hibb's TED Talk, that image is included, as well as many others that people might not like to see. But so this blue bra is because of an image that went around where a veiled woman was basically tackled to the ground by the army and stripped on the streets, and it revealed her blue bra.
Wow.
So in response to that, Hibb started graffitiing it everywhere. And, you know, this along with everything else that she put up on the walls, I think what's so powerful about this project is that not only does it highlight her as an artist and activist, but her stories from the protests document the art and the activism of others around her.
Yeah.
And in addition to, you know, attempted censorship by the government.
Yeah. So after she would graffiti the walls, do you know if the military or any other government people tried to paint over it?
Fantastic question, because I was about to transition to a very specific story that chronicles a singular wall on the streets of Cairo, and people can find the pictures of it in different stages on our Instagram. So it started with a mural done by a group of artists at the time. That's the very first picture. It shows a tank on one side and a child riding a bike with a basket of bread on top of his head on the other.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that was what it was originally. And then as the protests raged on and the military continued killing people and basically torturing everyone, another artist jumped in. And that's the next photo. He graffitied a gruesome scene, basically, of people being trampled by the tank.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So then, if you go to the next photo, government officials intervened. They graffitied an entirely new scene of people. They left the tank, which is hilarious to me. and then across from them, there was a group of people who were chanting, and it's written in Arabic, but it says, "Egypt for the Egyptians, the military and the citizens are of one hand."
Hmm.
That's a rough translation. So obviously, they try to censor the artwork and create this false fantasy that, oh, the people and the soldiers are one.
Yeah, just, you know, a little propaganda.
While, of course, leaving the tank. Then another artist came and tried to rectify that. So he graffitied over the scene of people. And that's the next photo with the image of a soldier who pretty much looks like a monster, really.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a civilian in his mouth. So it's a dead person, basically. And the soldier is just eating the person. So it's very gruesome. Yeah. And then after that, Chib showed up. She graffitied her nose and the blue bra all over it. Oh, but actually before that, the soldiers, when they saw the image of the kind of monster-looking militia man, they just threw a bucket of black paint to hide the face.
Okay.
I know. And again, left the tank, which is beyond me.
Yeah.
But after that, she showed up and she graffitied her nose and the blue bra all over it. I'm not sure whether it stands today as is, but at the time of her TED Talk, that was the last that she had documented it. That was what it looked like with her graffiti on it.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. And it's so wild that it's so great that people were able to photograph that and see that progression, right, of and the change that happened. That's wow.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, I think the importance of public art and political protest, I think it goes unnoticed a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, for me personally, I didn't really recognize just how significant it was until we started taking classes about it. And
right.
One thing that specifically comes to mind, I don't know if it comes to mind for you, is when we took modern African art together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our professor kind of highlighted how a lot of artists, especially artists in Mozambique, would go out and just paint public murals. And yeah, that's how they'd get the message across, right?
Yeah.
So.
And then I was even thinking, too, with like public art and activist art, thinking like in the 80s and 90s with like the mm-hmm. AIDS epidemic in New York,
yeah,
and a lot of artists working around there would do like public things. Well, and then I was also just thinking with like Keith Haring, and because he painted, right, like crack is whack for the drug problems. But yeah, anyway, mm-hmm. it really is interesting and could be really powerful, like, because of how many people you can reach.
Right, exactly. And I mean, just look at this singular wall, like all, yeah, the changes that happened to it. It was this back and forth battle between,
yeah,
the people and the government. I mean, the government was so angry about it that they had to intervene, you know,
yeah,
that they tried to censor it. So it's kind of insane. And
it's really cool too. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, go ahead.
It's just cool too how many artists collaborated on that,
yeah,
together. I mean, it sounds weird to think of like the military collaborating with artists on it, but just the fact that it started out as this one thing and then, you know, the military's
spiraled,
trying to intervene, and then you have the artist activist trying to take it back as their, yeah, own thing. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, this just like unintentional dialogue, this back and forth between the two parties, basically.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting. I mean, when I say emotional, I don't mean, you know, I was sobbing or anything, but just reading about the revolution and just about the public art and the graffiti really just took me back to when protests started back home in 2019,
mm-hmm,
and with all the violence and with everything that was going on, obviously all of that was tragic, and that's what you saw on social media most of the time. But another thing that became very, you know, that grabbed the attention and that I noticed in some photos was the graffiti art, and, mm-hmm, you know, was what people put up on the walls, and I'm sure much of it is still there today. So it's just really interesting because across history, you know, public art and graffiti have played a major role in the way folks protest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting too, because like when you were talking, just giving some background about the uprising in Egypt, like,
mm-hmm,
I mean, this was 2011, I was like 14 or something, I think. So I,
yeah,
was not paying attention to, I wasn't really tuned in to it when it was happening.
Yeah.
Like I knew there was something happening, but I didn't know the specifics of it.
Right.
And so then being able to learn about it and learn what was going on through the art that was produced during it as part of the protests is really neat, and it helps me understand and connect better with what happened as someone who obviously was not there and part of it.
Yeah. I agree. I think that's the beauty of art history. It just takes history one step further, adds that visual factor, and not just a visual factor in like a formal way, but it really, it's the actual people. This is what they're going through, and this is how they express themselves.
You know? Exactly. And in, you know, sometimes with like a painting or something, or even like with a film, it's less tangible because it's not something that you could see or would be allowed to touch with your hands. But with something like graffiti, I mean, as long as someone hasn't painted over it, you could go see it. In theory, you could be in the space with it, interacting with it, adding to it. And so it really lets you connect to it in a way that I think is really cool.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I mean, that... Obviously, this most of this focused on Chib specifically, but I did hope that the conversation would lead into us talking about public art, which we have in the past few minutes, because it is something that's just so important. And, you know, like I said before, I didn't really notice just how much up until like a couple years ago. So,
yeah, I think that even reminds me, too, of like, In like a different geographical context, I know that in maybe like the 80s and 90s, in Northern Ireland, when the troubles over there were going on in, I think Derry, there was, again, murals, like the IRA people would paint on their walls, and then like the British loyalists would paint on, I don't know if that's the right terminology. I'm not, I don't know a ton about that, but like, but even it's just, it's really fascinating to see this like happening all over the world in like different contexts, like people taking to the streets and like just expressing themselves and protesting on their own walls and in their own community.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, Chib, if you go to her website, she continues to use these notes, this graffiti, in public spaces all over the world. You know, she has them graffitied even in Beirut and Lebanon. Mm-hmm. She has them graffitied in Turkey, in Germany, in France.
Wow.
And really all, so she took it that one step further because she did believe in that idea of political art's influence in the political realm, and just kind of took that idea and ran with it, you know? And didn't just leave it exclusively to Egypt.
Yeah.
And because of her work, she was awarded the UNESCO Sharjah Prize for Arab Culture in 2016.
Oh, wow.
And she was the first Arab woman to receive the award, which is a big deal.
Oh, wow, I was going to say that's amazing, but also it seems like 2016, I can't believe she was the first, but...
I know, and for Arab culture, you know, you'd think, but finally in 2016, she received it and kind of broke that barrier, and hopefully many other women and, you know, anyone else from the queer community who practices art and within Arab culture will be able to receive this award eventually.
Yeah.
So...
What do you know, like, what other, any other projects, recent projects that she's been working on, too?
Mm-hmm. So, one of her more recent projects is called At the Corner of a Dream. It celebrates the work of the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. That's definitely, I mean, you look at those murals and they're very different from the graffiti. But it's a very interesting approach that she's taken. And again, she's taken these murals globally. So she's not just painting in a singular place. She's going all over, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. And then I just thought of another thing. And I don't know if you know this necessarily. But so in the case of if she's painting a mural and not, quote unquote, graffiti, is... like a gallery or a museum kind of commissioning her to paint a mural somewhere, or does she get permission from the building or the business owner where she's painting? I don't know if you've come across that in your research.
If you if you check out her website and you look at what she's done. So this is what she writes about the murals of At the Corner of a Dream. I paint poetry by the Palestinian poet of resistance, Mahmoud Darwish, on the walls of different cities around the world in new and original forms of the Arabic script. I use lines from his poetry to tell the world that ideas cannot be killed, to show that we are united in our humanity and our struggle against oppression and dictatorship. So it's an ongoing series, and again, painted in different cities around the world. I'm not sure explicitly about whether she's been commissioned by galleries or whether she's just been given permission to have access to public spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But it says here that she actually had the murals documented in a book published by Ginkgo Library in 2019.
Okay.
Yeah, but actually, if you do go to her website and you look at the specific page of the series, some of them, it seems like they are commissioned, because there's one that I'm looking at right now in Amsterdam that was painted at Mediamatic, which was an experimental cultural center there, and it's a permanent on-site mural now. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm sure she's probably collaborated with cultural centers or just artistic spaces in order to be able to do this. So.
Yeah, because I'm sure that it could be beneficial to partner with them, because I'm sure they would, mm-hmm. you know, ensure the longevity and the be able just to conserve the mural more easily if it's like an organization behind it.
Yeah, and you know what's funny? Actually, I just came across one that she has in Beirut, and she wrote that it was erased a week after it was painted. So, you know, I guess she tries to in certain places, some more official than others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so that's what she's been up to nowadays.
Cool. Well, she's really cool.
I figured you would enjoy it.
Yeah.
But that's all I have on her today.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, of course.
I definitely would recommend watching the TED Talk for anyone who hasn't. Now that you, after hearing all about her, I feel like I vaguely remember watching her TED Talk.
I'm sure. It blew up.
Yeah, and I don't remember where it would have been, but I do vaguely remember it, so.
It's very popular.
Yeah, but anyway, yeah, her stuff is really cool. I really like all the stuff that she's done.
I guess I could leave you with this one thought. She ended her TED Talk with this, so mm-hmm. I figured we could end the podcast with this as well. There's one work of hers that will be posted as well on our social media, which translates roughly to, "You can crush the flowers, but you can't delay spring."
Aww. Yeah. I love that. It's very hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think she ended it on a lovely note there, and that's how we'll end it today as well.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Maria.
Of course. Thank you for listening.
Yeah.
So how about you? What are you going to be sharing with us in a couple weeks?
So after talking about Molina Slam last time, I was inspired to keep going with film. So
yes.
For the next episode, I'm not going to talk about an artist who does anything really related to the environment or the land, mm-hmm. but I'm going to talk about a really cool female filmmaker named Maya Deren. Yeah, I was going to say, I think you're familiar with her, Maria, from our...
Just a little.
Yeah, from our feminist art history seminar, but
mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk about her again for the listeners because Amazing. She's really cool and a very important filmmaker that I don't think enough people know about.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very excited to learn more. It's been a while since that class, so...
Right, yeah.
I am ready to refresh on her, and I'm sure you're the perfect person to re-educate me on her work. So
I hope so. I'm excited.
Yeah, I can't wait. So I guess thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you then.
Yeah, thank you guys. Take care. Bye. Bye.